Gallipoli, Where's That? Part 2 of a story by Major Alan C. Bevilacqua, USMC retired. From the Leatherneck, November 2016. Read by Colonel Timothy S. Mundy, U.S. Marine Corps, retired. Quote, "Our success in the bitter fighting at Tarawa was due in considerable measure to the magnificent performance of the amphibian tractor," end quote. Lieutenant General Alexander A. Vandegrift, U.S. Marine Corps, Commandant of the Marine Corps, March 1944. While half of the world was at war, Victor H. Krulak, a captain now, was serving in Quantico, Virginia as Assistant Operations Officer on the staff of Brigadier General Holland M. Smith, the Commanding General of the 1st Brigade of the Young Fleet Marine Force, FMF. As events would prove, if ever a man was in the right place at the right time, that man was Victor H. Krulak. Upon returning from China in 1939, one of Krulak's first acts was a trip to headquarters U.S. Marine Corps to find what had happened to his report of the Japanese landing craft he had seen at Liahu. There it was, neatly filed away with a penciled notation in the margin describing the report as the work of some nut out in China. Tucking the entire report, photos and all, in his briefcase, Krulak carried the package to Quantico, where he showed it to Brigadier General Smith. One look at Krulak's report convinced Brigadier General Smith that this was something that had to be moved on quickly. With Krulak and the report in tow, Brigadier General Smith set out across the street to confer with Brigadier General Emil P. Moses, President of the Marine Corps Equipment Board. The result of that meeting was a telephone call to Andrew Higgins in New Orleans. Could Higgins come to Quantico to meet with Brigadier General Moses? Higgins would be there the next day, and he would bring his chief engineer with him. It would be a meeting between two men who took an immediate liking to each other, one which developed into a close friendship and proved to be of inestimable value to the Marine Corps. After viewing Krulak's report, Higgins was asked if he could modify one of his 36-foot boats to include a bow ramp. Andrew Higgins responded that he would do better than that. In 30 days, he would have a completely redesigned, entirely new boat, finished and ready for any test Brigadier General Moses wished to put it through. It wouldn't be too wrong to claim that the Landing Craft Vehicle Personnel, LCVP, was born that day at Quantico. While the LCVP was beginning to transition from idea to reality, there was a cocktail party in San Diego where two of the invited guests were Rear Admiral Edward C. Kalbfus, United States Navy, Commander Battleships, Pacific Fleet, and Major General Lewis McCarty Little, CG, Fleet Marine Force. Rear Admiral Kalbfus had brought with him an issue of Life magazine that contained an article the Admiral thought might be of interest to Major General Little. What Major General Little saw in Life magazine was a feature article touting Donald Roebling's Alligator and its potential as a rescue vehicle. Never a man to be thought of as a slow thinker, Major General Little saw at first glance another use for Roebling's amphibian. The Alligator could be the means of overcoming what had been the greatest shortcoming of the Gallipoli campaign. It could provide for the smooth transition of men and equipment between ship and shore. The next day, Major General Little mailed the magazine, along with his comments on the Alligator's promising usefulness in amphibious operations, to Major General Thomas Holcomb, who had recently assumed duties as Commandant of the Marine Corps. Major General Holcomb, quick to grasp the importance of Major General Little's mailing, wasted no time in forwarding the package down to the equipment board at Quantico. Further, the Commandant directed the equipment board to evaluate the Alligator and make a recommendation on the feasibility of the Marine Corps using the vehicle. The equipment board, perhaps anticipating the Commandant's directive, had already been moving on the matter, sending Major John Califf to meet with Roebling and see firsthand what the Alligator might have to offer. As these events were unfolding, Roebling, still thinking of his amphibian as a rescue vehicle, had found his business partner. In the town of Dunedin, Florida, the Food Machinery Corporation, just beginning to be known as FMC, maintained a large factory for the production of its line of machinery used in the canning of perishable foodstuffs. Donald Roebling made inquiries. Would FMC be interested in joining him in a joint venture in producing alligators for commercial sale? Oh, and by the way, the Marine Corps was sending a representative to meet with Roebling to explore the possibilities of finding military uses for the vehicle. There could be a market there that no one had contemplated. The executive board of FMC responded almost within hours. Not only would the company be interested in joining Roebling, but would be positively eager to do so. Backing up words with action, FMC assigned James M. Haight, a first-rate engineer, to work full-time with Roebling. From his top post at FMC's Lansing, Michigan plant, Bert Street was given the job of transforming the Dunedin plant to the production of alligators. Major Califf spent 2 weeks with Donald Roebling and the FMC engineering and production teams, watching Roebling's prototype alligator being put through its paces in the water and ashore. During his time at Dunedin, Califf took hundreds of photographs and more than 400 feet of motion picture film. He drove the vehicle in the water and on land, coming away convinced that Roebling's alligator was what the Marine Corps had been seeking. Major Califf's sole reservation lay with the alligator's aluminum construction. A thin-skinned vehicle wouldn't last long in combat. Could Roebling and FMC make the alligator from welded steel? The response was that the company could make the alligator from anything the Marine Corps desired, from cardboard to carbon steel. But would a welded steel alligator perform as well as the aluminum prototype? With an upgraded Lincoln Zephyr engine and a Ford standard transmission, a welded steel alligator not only would match the aluminum prototype, but would outperform it as well. Major Califf returned to Quantico convinced of the alligator's value to the Marine Corps and recommended that a model be procured for intensive testing. Things may have been going well for Donald Roebling and FMC, but down in New Orleans, Andrew Higgins had problems. The Navy, ever more on edge given events in Asia and the Pacific, was buying merchant ships and transforming them into troop ships. The Navy's growing fleet of new ships, designated Assault Transports, APA, were uniformly equipped with 36-foot davits for carrying and launching small boats. Suddenly, Andrew Higgins's LCVP became a very attractive item, one the Navy needed in a hurry. Could Andrew Higgins deliver 120 LCVPs in 2 weeks? A lesser man might have been knocked off his feet by such a request, but Andrew Higgins took challenges head-on and went in punching with both hands. His relatively small facility, however, had nothing near the capacity to produce landing craft in the volume the Navy had suddenly requested. Higgins convinced the city of New Orleans to block off City Park Avenue, the street that adjoined his plant. If he couldn't build the required number of boats indoors, he would build them outdoors. With that hurdle successfully cleared, there was still the obstacle of propeller shafts. The LCVP required a solid brass propeller shaft, and although America was not yet at war, brass was beginning to be increasingly in short supply with ever-increasing amounts devoted to munitions production. The sole source of solid brass rods in the required diameter, however, wasn't willing to sell. Willing or not, the necessary brass rods were acquired. Exactly how they were obtained is still a matter of speculation, but the necessary rods were acquired and eventually paid for. Once again, Andrew Higgins had demonstrated that he definitely wasn't a man to let anything stand in his way. Having secured the materials and space he needed, Higgins began making LCVPs in the middle of City Park Avenue. As soon as a boat, complete with solid brass propeller shaft, was finished, it was hoisted aboard a flatbed truck and delivered to the Navy. Working around the clock and using arc lights at night, Higgins's workforce had the entire order delivered within the 2 weeks requested by the Navy. The job would prove to be only a beginning. After America was plunged into the cauldron of war, workers at four additional Higgins boat yards labored 7 days a week to meet America's need for LCVPs. Money, money, money. Where would the money to purchase Donald Roebling's alligator and pay for a test program come from? As was the case with Andrew Higgins' brass propeller rods, the money did appear, although the means still are a bit unclear. What counted was that the Marine Corps was able to conduct detailed testing of Roebling's amphibian, which was designated Landing Vehicle Tracked Model No. 1, LVT-1. The officer in charge of the test program was none other than Captain Victor H. Krulak. With his team of two assistants, Sergeant Clarence H. Raper and Corporal Walter L. Gibson, Krulak put the LVT through a series of tests, pushing it to its limits on the Potomac River at Quantico. The LVT performed flawlessly, drawing suggestions for only minor modifications, which were incorporated into a follow-on model by Donald Roebling and the FMC team at Dunedin. The big test of the LVT occurred during Fleet Landing Exercise No. 7 at Culebra Island in the Caribbean during the autumn of 1940 and into the winter of 1940-41. Once again, the LVT performed beyond expectations, despite the fact that an over-exuberant Krulak half-drowned Admiral Ernest J. King, Commander-in-Chief, Atlantic Fleet. At the suggestion of the commander of the landing force, Krulak's immediate superior, Brigadier General Holland M. Smith, Krulak pulled the LVT alongside Admiral King's flagship, USS Wyoming. With Brigadier General Smith's compliments, Krulak offered, "Would the Admiral care for a short ride in the new amphibian?" Admiral King, who would in a few years become Chief of Naval Operations, wasn't all that interested, but as a courtesy to Brigadier General Smith, he accepted. Krulak gave the Admiral a brisk ride, demonstrating the LVT's capabilities. Unfortunately, he became a bit too enthusiastic. Ramming a coral head at full speed, the LVT threw a track and was hung up 30 yards from shore. A seething and fulminating Admiral King, never a mild man to begin with, levered himself over the side with a less-than-cheery smile and plunged into chest-deep water in the crisp white uniform and splashed his way ashore. If Victor Krulak thought his career had ended right there as a captain, it might not have been without reason. Mishap and all, the LVT had proven itself. Soon, there was an order for 200 such amphibians, which began being assigned to amphibian tractor battalions as the Fleet Marine Force grew from two skimpy brigades to six divisions. All the while, more orders were forthcoming. In time, FMC would require additional factories at Lakeland, Florida, and Riverside and San Jose in California. At the height of World War II, the FMC factories were turning out about 100 LVTs each month. The LVT would soon come to be known by a new unofficial name, Amphtrak. A short time later, the name was changed to Amtrak. It would not be long before the Amtrak stepped into the spotlight as an extremely valuable bit of machinery. With the arrival of spring in 1943, the Japanese tide that had swept across the Pacific for 6 months following the attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, had been forcefully checked by Marines at Guadalcanal. A short time later, in June 1942, the Japanese forces would be dealt another blow at Midway. America was now preparing for the task of carrying a prolonged amphibious war across the vast reaches of the Pacific, and like many times before, Victor H. Krulak would prove to be a decisive player. In May 1943, Krulak, a major now, had his first parachute battalion on the French islands of New Caledonia, some 750 miles east of Australia. While preparing for combat, he received an unusual and mystifying order. He was to turn over the training of his battalion to his executive officer and, with the assistance he required, perform a series of tests of the Pacific Campaign's game-changing vehicle. Securing a pair of fresh Amtraks from the factory, Krulak put them through punishing tests to determine how well the vehicles fared when surmounting a coral reef in high surf conditions. Essentially, Krulak and his team were directed to see just how much punishment an Amtrak could take to the point of wrecking both amphibians if necessary. There was no reason given for the testing. The tests Krulak and his crews conducted were brutal, requiring maneuvers that never before had been contemplated for Amtraks. In surf as high as 6 feet, the amphibians were rammed head-on into New Caledonia's Barrier Reef, the second largest such reef in the world, time and time again. Surprisingly, each crash resulted in next to no damage. The test Amtraks took on water from being all but submerged, but there was no leakage throughout the hull. The tracks and welded steel bodies took every bit of punishment that coral and high surf could muster, yet still they remained intact. The tests that Krulak had been directed to conduct, the reasons for which he was not told, were born out of a concern for the upcoming campaign at the Tarawa Atoll, not scheduled to occur until November, but for which planning was already underway. It was known that the island of Baishio, where the landings were scheduled to take place, was fronted by a barrier reef. It was also known from years of accumulated surf and tidal data in Australian archives that the waters around the Tarawa Atoll often were subject to unusually low neap tides at that time of the year. Would there be enough water over the reef to allow LCVPs to pass? If not, could Amtraks surmount the reef even under extreme surf conditions? In fact, when the assault waves of 2nd Marine Division crossed the line of departure on November 20, 1943, there was an unusually low neap tide at Baishio Island. There was not enough water over the reef for LCVPs to negotiate. Were it not for the ability of the Amtrak to surmount the natural obstacle, the Battle of Tarawa may well have been a blood-soaked disaster in which no living Marine ever set foot ashore. Tarawa was a beginning. From there, the war that had been feared 20 years before would lead westward. Faced with the supposedly impossible task of projecting forces over thousands of miles of open ocean and putting them ashore on dozens of defended islands, America was able to overcome the impossible and secure victory after victory in the Pacific. Thanks in no small part to Andrew Higgins, Donald Roebling, and the, quote, obscure lieutenant of Marines out in China, end quote, the price paid in blood at Gallipoli in 1915 was redeemed by America's victory in the Pacific in 1945. All of that was a long time ago, 70 years in the past. Today, there are those who claim that amphibious operations are a thing of the past because, quote, there will never be another war like that again, end quote. That conclusion may be argued endlessly. One thing that cannot be argued, however, is that 3/4 of the Earth's surface is covered by water. That is not a theory. Neither is it a computer simulation. It is a fact. What is also a fact is that America, alone among the world's countries, has the means to put forces ashore from any part of that worldwide ocean. That means is the Navy Marine Corps team and the legacy of the men who died at Gallipoli. Author's note: neither Andrew Higgins nor Donald Roebling accepted any monetary compensation for their invaluable contributions to America's war effort, asking only to be reimbursed for costs. Victor H. Krulak eventually wore 3 stars and commanded all Marines in the Pacific. Victor H. Krulak's son, Charles, served as the 31st Commandant of the Marine Corps from 1995 to 1999. Author's bio: Major Alan C. Bevilacqua, a Leatherneck contributing editor, is the former enlisted Marine who served in the Korean War and the Vietnam War, as well as on an exchange tour with the French Foreign Legion. Later in his career, he was an instructor at Amphibious Warfare School and Command and Staff College, Quantico, Virginia.